So we wanted to get every last drop of that. I had said, I might cut it off a little bit at the end, and then I put my headphones on and I couldn't do it. What an amazing tune, right? That is called Brother Thelonious, and it was done by Helen Sung, who we have with us right now. Helen, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Lisa. Thanks so much for having me.
A pleasure, and a pleasure to hear your music. And so who was with you on that that tune?
That tune it has the wonderful Seamus Blake on tenor saxophone, Ingrid Jensen on trumpet, Ruben Rogers on bass, Obed Calvert on drums, and Samuel Torres on percussion.
Fabulous. And, you know, many of the jazz musicians that I've interviewed have really benefited from living in New York City, where there's such a large number of jazz musicians. Is that how you're able to get a group like that together?
Well, that is such a true statement. I always tell when I meet aspiring jazz musicians and students, I said, if you can do it, try to spend some time in New York City. You don't have to end up living here, but you know, the level of musicianship and artistry, the volume of amazing stuff going on every night, you know, any given night you can go hear greatest artists in the world, and that's so inspiring and challenging and terrifying all at the same time.
I bet it is for you. Yeah, I mean, honestly, it must. I imagine. I'll ask you the question. I mean, is it a little bit awe inspiring? I mean, you are obviously very famous yourself, oh my goodness. I started to ask you, I had to look up your age, because at first I thought you were much younger than you actually are. And I was going to say, how in God's name did you do all this in that amount of time?
Oh, well, it's another, I'd have to thank my parents.
All right.
Good genes, I guess.
Did you have kind of a tiger mom? Or?
You know, I didn't actually, which is very interesting, because it's reading about that book that made such a splash a couple of years ago. My parents were actually really relaxed about the music thing. They were very unhappy, actually, that I ended up wanting to go into music. They wanted, you know, they were immigrants, and I used to get upset that why don't they support me more? But now that I'm older, I understand that, you know, they came here making a life, just trying to survive, and music couldn't, just for very time-wise and economic-wise, you know, couldn't really be a part of their lives. But they worked so hard to give me and my brother and sisters a life where we could, take piano lessons, take violin lessons, and then to have the luxury of even making a choice of considering that for a profession. So I feel very grateful and very lucky.
You know, I'll ask you, though, I mean, was it like the configuration of this, they were thinking, oh, no, the piano, and then, oh, no, jazz, no, not that.
How did you know? Well, they were okay with the classical piano, although they weren't happy. At least they had a frame of reference. And I remember my dad would always say, well, you know, we know that you can teach piano lessons. And I remember thinking, you know, nothing wrong with teaching, but man, I'm practicing so many hours a day. I want to play. We didn't have models of artists in our life. Nobody in my family had ever been an artist. So I just thought maybe my life would, you know, based on what I saw amongst my peers, I went to the University of Texas at Austin for my undergrad. People would end up with teaching jobs at colleges, and they do performing as a very vital part of that. And I said, that sounds pretty good. But then, you know, I felt so lucky to have been exposed to jazz, I was ready to be exposed to jazz, because I went to that high school, that performing arts high school in Houston that so many truly famous jazz artists have come from. And yeah, so when I told my parents when I was done with my undergrad degree, and I said, you know what, I think I want to study jazz, I think they thought I had gone nuts.
I'm sitting here laughing. And, you know, you anticipated my next question, because I read an article in the New York Times months and months ago, and it was about Houston, right? And so, of course, you know, being a New York-centric person, and I do admit that I kind of see the world like that New Yorker cartoon, you know, like there's nothing in between. And I say that unabashedly, but the article was about jazz musicians coming out of Houston, right? And it started off, I was looking at Jason Moran, who I value so much as, a vital part of Charles Lloyd's group as well as his own work. But when I started to read it, there are so many of you that came out of Houston. Like, what is in the water in Houston?
Well, I really think a lot of credit goes to Dr. Robert Morgan. We call him Doc. And I remember I was terrified of him when I was in high school, because he would have this very stern look on his face and he'd be stalking up and down the hall. But he really gave these artists, and I remember hearing Robert Glasper talk about it. He said, when he got to New York and took his first year at New School, he's like, I've already done this. So it's like Doc gave him that freshman experience already, just in his, from his experience and the stuff that he made them do and expected from them. And that created, I think, a self-perpetuating cycle where so many amazing artists come from that high school. Anybody coming after them feels that a healthy pressure, you know, they got to represent and carry on H-Town and stuff like that. So I was so honored when they were like, yeah, Helen, we adopt you, you know, we graft you into the HSPBA jazz legacy. And I think it was like maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago where I finally played on my first HSPBA fall jazz concert as a guest.
Wow.
So it was, it's just a really fun to see what keeps happening there. You know, Warren Sneed, he's a wonderful saxophonist who's taken over for Doc, who has retired, and they continue churning these amazing jazz artists out. So it's just an honor to be a part of that legacy.
You know, the other thing that I want to raise, and then I want to get back to you because these are tributaries and not where I really wanted to head, but, you know, it seems to me like when you look at someone like Robert Glasper, Jason Moran, they very often are talking about trying to take jazz in another direction. And I'm interested in that. Is that a part of the Houston experience, or is that just them?
I think it's a part of the jazz experience, to be honest, because I studied jazz at the Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz Performance. It started out at the New England Conservatory in Boston, which is how this Houstonian ended up on the East Coast. But something, you know, that was a very unique program in that we studied directly with the masters of the music. You know, our first teacher was Clark Terry, then Jackie McLean, Jimmy Heath, you know, people
wow.
like that. Barry
Holy
Harris.
Cow. Yeah.
I know, I was freaking out. Ron Carter was our artistic director. I mean, just having this bass legend come and kick our behinds for 2 years. I mean, it was an amazing experience. But they always said to us, all of them, you know, that in their own ways, they said, you know, we want you to know this tradition. We want you to respect it and understand it, but we also want you to move the music forward.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy Heath always has the greatest sayings. He said, first you imitate, then you assimilate, and then you innovate. So I think it's part of the restlessness of this amazing music and art form.
You know, and I have to say that there's so much spectacular music that comes out just about every week. And, you know, as a programmer, it's a little bit daunting at this point because, you know, the way I would program, I want to have, you know, your music, but then I want to play Thelonious Monk, you know, and you can't squeeze it all into 3 hours.
Oh, you know, that's such a unique challenge, I think, that jazz artists face, because I think it speaks to the greatness of this music. I mean, it's eternal. People will be listening to Duke Ellington forever. People will be listening to Thelonious Monk forever. And when the time that they lived, there was enough work and enough listeners to go around, or just ways of presenting the music. And now it's like we have to compete against our heroes in some way. And, you know, they call it catalog, right? So just thank you. Because, again, then they jazz programming seems to keep getting squeezed more and more. So just thank you for doing what you do and playing the music of today that you play, because I know it must be an incredible challenge. I would not want to be in your shoes.
Well, I appreciate that. I think your actual work is much more challenging, and I'm always amazed that people can do what they can do on the piano. And I always, we're going to talk about the jazz standard in just a minute, but I always try and get, you know, that seat that's right next to the piano?
Yes!
That's my seat. If I can get into that seat, that's where they put me. I try and get there early because that's the instrument that I'm most, amazed by, because it just seems to you it probably seems like but
no, it's a beast.
I'm sure people that play classical piano would argue with me about this, and I really don't care. I think the jazz piano is very difficult. And
as speaking as a former classical pianist, because it's such a holistic art form, you know, in classical, you tend to focus on the notes, the written notes and interpretation of those notes and studying of the composer's intentions and all the different editions of the, you know, extant scores and stuff like that. But jazz, you have to know everything, harmony, how harmony works, melody, the creation of good melodies, then this language of jazz improvisation, rhythm. Oh, God, that's a whole world in itself.
It's so complicated.
I love it because I feel like it's a music for the head as much as for the heart.
I totally agree with that.
So, you know, a lot of listeners always say to me, I don't feel like I don't understand. And I say, well, you know, if you want to understand it more, you can, you know, because it's really a language. And if you learn some of the basic principles of how the language works, yeah, you can know what's happening on stage, maybe more on a technical level. But I said, just listen, let it move your soul, your heart, your feet start tapping. That's, you know, trust yourself.
Yeah. I mean,
there's no big secret.
I mean, that was kind of the Blue Note recipe, wasn't it? That they wanted music that, you know, you could walk out of a jazz club and kind of remember, but something that was, but something that was interesting enough and cerebral enough. You know, I watched a video over the weekend of Giant Steps, and why this is how nerdy I can be. So, you know, the video is about why that song was so revolutionary and so so complicated to play. But the part that, you know, and you don't have to comment on this if you don't want to, but they were talking about Tommy Flanagan, who's on that cut.
Oh, and the infamous story.
I know, right? Well, I have to say, you know, I first of all, it's like, I can imagine sitting down and looking at that for the first time and having to play it on the piano. I mean, can you give us some insight?
I've heard that he thought it was a ballad. I mean, all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But I think it wasn't quite fair because Coltrane had been working on that for who knows how long, and he was, as by all accounts, incredibly diligent, and like he'd be practicing during in between sets during gigs and stuff. And I actually think Tommy sounds fine on it.
Me too.
But he doesn't sound like like Coltrane, of course, because Coltrane had his own thing worked out and he was working it out. So I feel bad that's kind of how Tommy is, his most famous story. I never had the nerve to ask him about it when I met him.
Yeah, I could see why that might not be top on your list of things to do. But you know what my take on it is, as someone who's not a musician, is that he just is playing more slowly than Coltrane is. He couldn't keep up with that pace.
Well, to me, he was playing the bebop language over those changes, which he did well. But those changes, they were not about bebop. It was this more angular language that Coltrane really, you know, he brought up in a large part. He brought about it. It was not as chromatic a language. It was much more angular and horizontal, you know, that's the best way I can describe it. It's not chromatic. It's they call it modal, kind of. But
yeah,
well, it's kind of like the perfect synthesis. Actually, it's like Coltrane took the bebop language as far as it could go, and it was that pivot in Giant Steps, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So to play that song the way it should sound, it's Coltrane, but it's not like you can just do it unless, you know,
unless you practiced it.
Well,
that's how you get to Carnegie Hall, right?
Exactly.
So
exactly.
Speaking of Carnegie Hall, so first let me tell everyone, you are listening to WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and I'm here with Helen Sung. I'm so honored to have the opportunity to speak with her. She's going to be at the Jazz Standard on December 13th, and she's going to be there with Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, which I'm going to talk to her about in just a minute.
Yay.
And we have a pair of tickets to give away for this Jazz Standard concert. But we're going to do that after we hang up with Helen, so we're not wasting her time with answering the phone, because I'm sure you have a lot of piano to practice, right?
Yes, thank you.
So tell us about your Jazz Standard gig. What do you have on the tap for that?
Well, this is a CD release show, and I apologize if you don't have a CD. Do you have the new CD yet?
I don't, and I wish I did, because I realized that that was, you know, the missing element. You are more organized than I am. I got up here, and
No worries. Yeah. No. Yeah, well, that's okay. It'll be a surprise then for the listeners. But it's my new CD, which I released in September. It's called Sung with Words, a collaboration with Dana Gioia, and it's like a long time coming, a project that I've wanted to do in for a while. And the actual collaboration and the work that came out of it was made possible by a new Jazz Works grant from Chamber Music America, funded by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation. And Dana Joy is a wonderful American poet. I met him when he was chairman of the National Endowment. He served two terms. And we met at the White House, of all places.
Oh, my God, really? Wow.
Yeah. I was performing for the PBS series in performance at the White House, and they had a state dinner before we did the live taping, and I just happened to be seated next to Dana, and we hit it off. We started talking. I was like, wow, you're the first live poet I've ever met, and I was really impressed. He knew two of my favorite science fiction writers, Ray Bradbury and Orson Scott Card, and so I met him and his wife, Mary, and we became friends. He sent me poetry. I sent him my CDs, and, you know, I admitted to him. I said, you know, I haven't read much poetry since high school because I never felt comfortable that I wasn't sure of meaning sometimes. I always felt like I was the only person in the room that didn't get it. And Dana really has this gift, I think, like Wynton Marsalis has with jazz and Leonard Bernstein with classical music, for making it accessible, poetry accessible to people like me. And he said something that I found so profound. He said, you know, poetry is a temporal art form like music. It's meant to be heard out loud. It's meant to come off the page. And he said he felt like if schools, you know, he said most of the times in high school they give you a poem and you have to write a paper about it, and it never really comes off the page. And he said, read poetry out loud. Listen to the words, the rhythm, the consonants, the flow. Don't worry so much about meaning. It'll come at you sideways. And I started doing that. And then I started like imagining sometimes a line to a melody or a rhythm. And I realized it would really...
No.
I realized it would really...
I thought I lost you for a minute there.
Yeah,
I was oh no.
It's a panic. No, I had a... I realized the poem would come alive with meaning. So I said, well, let me see if I can set this poem to music. So I started, you know, experimenting with poems by Gwendolyn Brooks, Langston Hughes, Emily Dickinson, you know, and some modern poets. And then eventually Dana was like, well, we need to write some songs together. So that's what we did. And the CD has 10 songs, 7 that use vocalists and 3 instrumental songs that are inspired by words. So, you know, the 7 songs with vocalists, I've actually taken poems that Dana, we kind of wrote them together, or he brought them to me. It was like a, you know, in a certain interview we did, he said we just did whatever worked with each poem, and I made them into lyrics, and Cecile McLaurin-Savant will sing them, and also Carolyn Lenhart, because there are some duets. And then the instrumental songs are inspired by words. One is called Lament for Khalif Browder, which I wrote after reading the New York Magazine article by Jennifer Gonerman about Khalif Browder. It has to do with just the horrible injustice and problems of incarceration in our country. And there's also another one called In the Shadowland, which is inspired by that line from C.S. Lewis in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Chronicles of Narnia. And then Convergence, which kind of ties up the whole theme of the project of just converging in many elements of people, of time, of stories. And then, the first instrumental I wrote was called Into the Unknown, which kind of was the adventure of this project. So I'm so excited about this music. I respect Dana so much. I worked so hard on the music. I must have written like hundreds of drafts of one of the songs because I just wanted to get that melody just right. And I'm just really pleased and think the musicians did an amazing job with the record, and really excited to share it with New York City at the Jazz Standard.
I can't wait to hear it.
Thank you. And
we have tickets available for this. The Jazz Standards is in New York City. The reason I'm saying that is because last week when I gave away tickets, somebody said, "Where is it?" I'm like, why don't you know that? but to avoid that, it is in New York City. It's down Lexington and 27th. And
116 East 27th between Park and Lex. I just played there last night. That's why.
and Helen Sung is going to be there on December 13th with Cecile McLaurin-Salvant. I wanted to ask you, how did you hook up with Cecile McLaurin-Salvant?
Well, you know, I'm a fan, of course. And we first worked together when Jazz at Lincoln Center asked me to be musical director for the National Endowment for the Arts Jazz Masters Award. It was at Rose Hall. And she was one of the artists that they wanted to include on the program. And so I arranged a song for her. And that's when we first worked together. And then I've seen her in passing at, you know, different concerts, mm-hmm. and we perform on the different artists, but on the same bill. And so I was really excited when this year they asked me to play for her new project called Ogress, which is an amazing...
That's right. I saw you. I forgot about that.
You saw that?
How could I possibly forget that that was you? Yes, of course.
Ah!
It was fabulous. I mean, what a spectacular...
You saw it at NJ Pack or at the Metropolitan Museum?
I saw it at the Metropolitan Museum, And, you know, I have to tell you that I've interviewed Bill Frisell. I've interviewed, you know, Maria Schneider, you, right? I am afraid of Cecile McLaurin-Salvon. Do you know that I am? I have never reached...
She is such a sweetheart.
I'm sure she is, you know, but she is a little bit like talking to Ella Fitzgerald or Sarah Vaughan. You say no, right?
I could see why you would say that.
Yeah.
I could see why you say that. And that project, you know, that was my debut on Melodica, too, which I thought was hilarious. But, Such an amazing work.
That's right.
I would call it like a jazz operetta almost.
And I forgot you were playing that. That's right.
Yeah. So we did two more shows after that at NJPAC and Kennedy Center. And when I, you know, confirmed the gig at Jazz Standard, I was like, man, I would love to have her sing it. And I asked her and I was like, he said yes. Oh.
Yeah, that, you know, she, I like the optic of it too, because, you know, she's had Aaron Deal accompany her for a long time,
yes.
and then Sullivan
yes.
Fortner. So I kind of like
yes.
the idea. Maybe she'll switch over to the female side of the piano equation for a while.
Oh no, I don't want to take anybody's gig. I mean, Sullivan's fabulous. And
he is.
So
yeah.
is Aaron, and I'm just so excited to hear her interpret this music, and we're gonna probably do similar. You know, we get two sets, and we only have one night, so I'm gonna, you know, you. I would love her to sing on both sets, and so I'm going to tweak the set so that we'll get as much Cecile as much as possible, and Carolyn too, who I love and have worked with a long time, and it's a fabulous band too, so I'm super excited.
Are you going to record it?
You know, I didn't think about that.
I wish you would, because I would love to have you come back on at some point and talk to you some more about that, because that sounds like a fabulous project.
Okay.
So I want to thank you, Helen Sung, for your time.
Thank you, Lisa.
And so we're going to head over, you'll be happy to hear this, over to Cecile McLaurin-Salvon in just a minute. But I want to thank Helen Sung very much for her time.
And my pleasure.
It's been fascinating to talk to you, and I wish you all the success in your very successful career.
Thank you, and I hope to say thank you and hello in person, and thank you for playing the music, and we'll send you a copy of Sung With Words.
Thank you. Well, I'll tell you, if I am successful, then I will be sitting right behind you.
Yay!
So we'll see. Cross your fingers.
Please say hi, then.
I'll give you a little wave. Okay, talk soon.
All right, take care. Bye.
Thank you. So that was Helen Sung, and I have I want you to write this down, because we're going to be giving tickets away, but not necessarily in the order that you're expecting, okay? So the number is 203-336-9756. That number again is 203-336-9756. And I have pairs of tickets for the following. But you have to wait until I get off the air. You're cheating. If that was you. Let me wait till I start playing the music so I can answer the phone. So 203-336-9756. So I have pairs of tickets for Firehouse 12, and I have tickets for Old Lyme Inn, and I have tickets for the Jazz Standard to see Helen Sung. And so I'm going to be giving those tickets away. We're going to play a little bit more music. I'm going to come back on the air, and I'll tell you what's going on at the Old Lyme Inn, because that is where we are going to start. And we're going to continue here